Speaker is Allison Eagle. She's formerly of Duke University and is currently with the University of Alberta. Allison?
Thank you, Brian, and thanks for the invitation to speak with all of you today. It's going to be a slightly different flavor as we talk about bringing all the information from science that where you're all situated into some of the applications through programs and projects. So this is some of the work that I've been doing through Duke University over the last couple years. And my co-author, Lydia Olander, is the Ecosystem Services Director at the Nicholas Institute for Environmental Policy. I'd like to acknowledge the Packard Foundation, which has been acknowledged for providing funding for a significant amount of other research in this area as well. So we're working on looking at the different market and program options of actually bringing nitrous oxide emission reductions into some kind of implementation. And the possibilities include private or voluntary greenhouse gas mitigation markets, which there's a little bit of action there, cap and trade legislation, which would then include voluntary offsets using some of the same protocols that have been developed in the private and voluntary market. The talk about that being in a national perspective in the U.S. is pretty much dead, but that's happening in Alberta and Canada as well as in California. It's in the works to do a cap and trade legislation where large emitters would be capped their emissions, and then they could either reduce their own emissions or pay someone else to have the same true impact on the atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases. Incentive programs to mitigate greenhouse gases, so that's something that would be within, say, the Farm Bill or other USDA programs, conservation initiatives. And then corporate-driven supply chain requirements are another option for integrating emission reductions. And that's something that has been happening through some of the sustainability initiatives with Walmart and other organizations that are trying to integrate a climate change mitigation portfolio within their sustainability requirements. All of these different options need a significant amount of technical and background scientific information in order to achieve a couple of different goals. The first one is, of course, to ensure that through these projects and protocols, programs, that we actually get environmental progress, that the money that is paid for the greenhouse gas mitigation actually achieves greenhouse gas mitigation. And then we also need to have good information to ensure that farmers are fairly compensated for the environmental service that they are providing, which is of public value. And these information needs are context specific to the different options that are listed above. So the work that we are doing is in translating from the agricultural science and into the application. So that's kind of the nexus of where this work is. And some of the needs that we have tend to have umbrella over all of the different policy and project options. We need accurate biogeochemical response data, and we need to have a good understanding of realistic scenarios in agriculture and in implementation of different options for mitigation. And we also need to know how we could go about quantifying the reductions in a program or project sense, so not in a research scenario. And then moving through the translation to the application, where the economics comes in, we need to have a good understanding of the cost structures of these different practices and do some economic and policy analysis where we look at the transaction costs. How much does it cost to actually market these offsets or other mitigation? And what are the costs of monitoring and of verification and aggregation? How does aggregation fit in? And then looking at some of the buzzwords that are in the greenhouse gas market, we have baseline, additionality, and leakage. And this slide forms the outline of what I'm going to address today. So you'll see all of these again, and it's just to give an idea of where we'll be heading. So we have some different programs that have different information needs. For example, when we started our project with the Technical Working Group on Agricultural Greenhouse Gases at Duke, we weren't really considering the quantification of upstream and process emissions. And then supply chain initiatives started coming into play, and we realized that if the supply chain mitigation options become reality, they're looking at life cycle analysis. And so we need to consider upstream and process emissions and be able to quantify those accurately as well. Whereas under a cap and trade program, we wouldn't need this because those upstream and process emissions are already addressed upstream in the fertilizer production or other manufacturing. So that's already covered in a cap and trade system. And some of the others where we might or might not need to consider upstream and process emissions are in the voluntary offsets or public incentive programs, and it depends on whether or not these programs would want to consider life cycle analysis or just focus on the specific activity and the specific change that's happening in the field. Then we also need information on quantification tools and what are we going to use and what is appropriate or economically feasible to use in a programmatic sense. So can we do measurement or models, or what are the appropriate models, and then at what scale, and all those kinds of things. And so then we also need to know what the cost structure of that quantification is and how much will it cost to be able to accurately measure how much reduction in greenhouse gases we have. And the other information that we need is baseline adoption information, and this can be at a regional scale to be able to guide design decisions. So do we know that in region A we already have a certain level of use of nitrification inhibitors, for example, and does that mean that incentivization of that would even be a worthwhile effort or not? Or is there or other kind of things too? And then the other information we need is to know what's the total area available for implementation of a certain activity, and we can use that to determine the potential and whether it's even worth designing a protocol, developing a program, whether we'll achieve sufficient greenhouse gas mitigation to make it worthwhile of the effort involved. And then we also need to know, in some cases, depending on the program, we may need to know farm-level baseline information. So starting with the biogeochemical response data, this is where most of you are working in this, and to be able to accurately determine what the physical response is of implementing different projects or different practices. We always have to consider regional and soil and other factors and be able to quantify the uncertainty. Even if we have high uncertainty, the people in the marketing of greenhouse gas mitigation credits of sort are totally okay with having uncertainty as long as we can quantify it. Because if we say we have a 1 ton per hectare of mitigation happening and the uncertainty is 20%, then that's just discounted so that we can guarantee we have 0.8 tons and we have a good understanding of where we can make sure that person is paying for an environmental benefit. And the response data from the physical side is also specific to readily identifiable activities, and that's really important for being able to design programs to say, if you implement this specific activity, this is the response you're going to get. And some of the data that are out there are not what I've seen this morning presented, but in some cases we may have an integrated system and a conventional system, and then there may be more than one identifiable activity, and we don't understand which activity is actually having the impact, and so we need to be able to separate them out and have an understanding of the mechanisms as some people were explaining earlier this morning in this session. And we're getting a far better understanding of the mechanisms behind different greenhouse gas mitigation. And again, interactions between the activities are important, when you need to be able to design a program, you need to know whether if you implement activity A and B together, how much is the response going to change. So in our work at Duke, we were looking at the available data to be able to even say what kind of biophysical information is there. And this looks slightly different from what Rod presented earlier, but it's not totally disagreeing with what he said, because this is number of observations and he was talking about number of studies. So sometimes we have multiple observations within one study. So that's where we were looking at, is the total number of observations. So we may have different cropping systems and that implemented the same activity and reported in the same paper. So reducing the nitrogen fertilizer rate, we have a pretty good idea for regional coverage in the Corn Belt, the Great Plains, the Lake States, and the Rocky Mountains. But if you look at some of these others, we have, does this mouse work? Oh, there we go. Changing the fertilizer nitrogen source from ammonium-based to urea. The only information is available comes from the Lake States, a lot of the work from Rod Venturia's group, and the south central part of the U.S., and then some information from Canada. And then if we look into changing fertilizer nitrogen timing, all of the data that are available at this point come from Canada. So that's including the fall to spring application difference, as well as the split application. And if we look at, say, irrigation improvements, we have some information that, but very little data. So we have a lot of expert opinion, but the only data that are available are coming from Canada and from Asia, and we have a 4 observations. So this gives an idea of how much information is out there, and as we are seeing coming to these meetings, ends up bringing these numbers up because there are a lot of papers that have just been published recently available. So I can see these numbers changing significantly over the next year or so. So some of the research gaps in physical science, and this is where hopefully you all will be working in this area and answering some of these questions. We have a significant lack of data for some key regions. And the question that should then be asked, do we need to obtain that data for those regions, or can we carry over the information from one area and say that it also applies in another region? So regions as well as cropping systems and things like that. So how much can the information and the understanding of the mechanisms be utilized in designing emission factors or other modeling for a region that doesn't actually have data available. So do we need more data as a result, or if we're going to implement a program over the short term, should we just initially exclude certain regions from that program because there is a lack of information available? And then we need to be able to better understand the mechanism for emission reductions and the interactions between activities, and that's something that needs significantly more research in order to be able to implement programs and protocols that include multiple activities. So, for example, we need to understand how a decrease in rate and the changing in application timing might interact with each other. And as in the previous talk by Rod Venturia, we need to understand if some of these changing in nitrogen source, then how that affects the change in rate and how those would then interact with nitrous oxide emission reductions. We also don't necessarily have a very good handle on the variability, and we need that in order to be able to design discounts for payments and get an idea of what we can guarantee the environmental impact will be. And then we also don't necessarily have a good understanding of the non-target greenhouse gas effects. So what does a change in the adoption of a certain practice do to soil carbon, or what is the impact on methane, just so that we can make sure we have a full greenhouse gas accounting in these programs and protocols so that we don't have unintended consequences of that negate the benefit we were trying to achieve. The other thing, hopefully, and I know that as scientists, we don't always have a very good understanding of the realistic scenarios on the farms, but I would think, and I from experience in interacting with other economists, I think that the agricultural scientists have a far better understanding of realistic scenarios on the farm than a lot of my economist colleagues. So this is where we need your help as well. And are there yield trade-offs? And that's something that you can answer in certainly not even by interacting with the farmers, but how does the potential benefit compare with estimated product or commodity income? So if we have a benefit payment of, you know, $30 an acre or something like that, which is way higher than we would actually ever see, but how does that compare to the income from the farm product, and is that even at all an incentive for a farmer? And then also, would the farmers in Region A in a specific area willingly consider reducing fertilizer nitrogen or adopting some other practice that could reduce nitrous oxide emissions? What are some of the barriers to adopting these activities? And So that kind of information we need to have a good handle on so that we can know whether it's even worth trying to work with farmers to get them to do this. And then what sort of incentives would be needed to help these activities be better adopted. And then also, one thing that many scientists, especially in the nutrient management area, have been working on, and in extension as well, are tools for managing some of the potential risks associated with adopting various activities that have the potential to reduce nitrous oxide. So why are farmers applying more nitrogen than they may need? And if they were to reduce, do we have enough tools to be able to address the perceived risks or the real yield risks that they're feeling is why they need to be applying extra nitrogen? So in these whole farming systems and understanding the realistic scenarios, some of the other research gaps that exist are information on what crops do we actually have excess nitrogen applications, and so what are the best targets to start with, and so that we can pick the low-hanging fruit, as Will Horweth mentioned. And if there are crops that have excess nitrogen applications, and then to have a better understanding, like I said before, as to why farmers apply more nitrogen than they need. And then also we need some other baseline management data, and I'll go into that a little bit later. So then we need to have a good understanding of what quantification tools we can use in order to implement projects and protocols. And in the IPCC scenarios, we have the various tiers of quantification, and the tier one being large-scale default emission factors, which everybody knows is the 1% of nitrogen rate and doesn't consider any of the other activities, so it's just based on rate in the nitrous oxide and fertilizer area. And then we have tier two, which would be a hybrid of the tier one and tier three that gets much more specific. So tier two has a finer spatial and temporal resolution, and the application depends on the available information. So it can be really used well for project-based accounting, especially because we can have region-specific emission factors and can include multiple activities as long as there are sufficient data to be able to design those factors. Tier three ends up being far more specific, farm level, can have a significantly greater cost just because of the scale is much more fine scale, but can be more flexible because of multiple practices, and can also, especially with modeling, can really incentivize, can really help with innovation for farmers because they can try different activities and see how that would affect their total emission structure. So, as I mentioned, scale is kind of important. We need to have a balance between accuracy that's obtained through the quantification method of choice and also the scale to be able to reduce the cost. So accuracy, we need to be able to minimize the uncertainty so that we can maximize the payment to a farmer. And we also can't do it at too fine of a scale because then we have far too high costs. So for example, if we're doing some back of the envelope calculations, we can look at a typical emission reduction achieved from one of the nitrogen management activities, a benefit of half a ton of CO2 equivalents per hectare per year, and say a carbon market pays $10 a ton. That's a lot higher than what the CCX was paying before it went defunct last year, a little bit lower than some of the prices that were mentioned earlier by Cliff this morning. Then if we have 25% uncertainty and we have 25% transaction costs, then that reduces the price that the farmer's only going to get about $5 a ton. So the total value of those credits are $324 for a quarter section. Farmers would only get $162 of that for one quarter section, for 160 acres. So is that going to be sufficient incentive for a farmer to actually make a change? So can farmers respond to these payments or other incentives? Will the money actually cover the costs of the practice that they have to change? We need to be able to prioritize the activities for programs or maybe eliminate some of those activities that would be too costly and thus unlikely to be adopted. So for these cost structures, we have very few data available. A lot of it is just best guesses that people are making for marginal cost curves. If we want to develop cost structures, it's pretty easy when we're trying to think about nitrification inhibitors or drip irrigation or changing a fertilizer source, because it's just paying for the cost of the equipment or the extra cost of fertilizer. But if we end up having a yield impact or a risk or even perceived or real, then the cost can be significantly higher, just because it's going to cost a lot more to incentive a farmer to make a change, to help them cover the risk. So if we look at transaction costs, if a program requires a minimum of 6,000 tons per year of CO2 equivalents, that's $60,000 value per project. We're looking at 12,000 hectares of farmland, so 46 sections, 25% transaction costs. Then, and if that money can, if that, those transaction cost money can be used to pay for measurement, verification, and obtaining market access, we've got $15,000 per year for an aggregator to use to bring to market the greenhouse gas mitigation that could be achieved from 12,000 hectares of farmland. So it has to, the scale of quantification has to be large, has to be efficient, and all that. So, and then also the question of whether a farmer can make it work. So this all sounds pretty dire. So are there other incentives for a best management practice that might work to make it more cost effective? Well, if we have lower cost of fertilizer, we may have less risk for water quality regulation, or stack payment for other environmental goods and services, which might make this all more possible. But what's the real cost of greenhouse gas mitigation? Did some quick look into some of the other things. If we look at, we're looking at $10 a ton or $15 a ton for some of the existing programs and thoughts for agricultural mitigation. But some of the actual policies that have been implemented over the last while were hybrid car rebates and low carbon fuel standards and cash for clunkers. And these had much higher costs per ton of greenhouse gases that were actually mitigated. So there's potential for so the agricultural greenhouse gas mitigation is significantly less expensive, and I would argue there's potential for the prices to go up to actually make it work in agriculture. And then we have policy and program design issues of leakage, how do changes in production elsewhere affect the greenhouse gases. We need to be able to understand the baseline, what's business as usual without the project, and this has both biophysical and management aspects. And some of the standardized approaches reduce transaction costs. Additionality is related to baseline, and we need to know for sure that that the action would have taken place just because of the incentive that was paid. And some decisions need to be made about the projected change without the program, so all those are policy decisions that have to come in. We did a little bit of work on baseline determination. If anybody wants to look at that later, you can talk to me. But basically, the important point here is that when we're moving from agricultural science and translating it and trying to get into application in a programmatic or policy sense, we really need the interdisciplinary communication. The people in economics that I've been working with need the help of the agricultural science community to be able to understand how better to advise people who are designing programs and protocols. So, any questions? Yes.
Yeah, I was interested in your economics, some of the numbers you were throwing out there. You threw the number $30 an acre out there and said, well, that's more than we would ever pay. In my experience in working with farmers, if you're relying on the incentive alone to motivate change, and there's not some other benefit in the change of practice to the farmer, $30 an acre is not going to be sufficient to make that change, from my experience. Now, if, as Cliff Snyder and some of the other speakers have talked about, if that truly means moving to a best management practice that results in better economics for the farmer, greater productivity, things like that, then $30 an acre is great. But if you're relying strictly on the incentive alone to result, to motivate that change, it's nowhere near enough, in my opinion. So, just something to consider that whatever changes
Yes, the incentive for just greenhouse gas mitigation is unlikely to, at the current prices, is unlikely to be able to cover the cost for achieving a change in activity. And that's why I have here that are there any other incentives for best management practice that might make the activity more cost effective? And so then in a lot of cases, what we're looking at is what are the barriers and how can we just overcome that barrier? Because once that barrier is overcome, then the costs really aren't that significant. And so then after you've had that initial change and getting over that, I haven't done this before, I don't know how to do this, getting over that kind of thing, if you have a catalyst to make that happen, then we may be able to achieve something with the small incentive payments that could come out of a greenhouse gas mitigation program.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Allison. Let's give her a hand.